Welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo? It's been a while since I spoke to you now.
Yeah, indeed. How's it going, John? I'm good here.
Awesome. It's going great here as well. I feel kind of bad that we haven't been able to do more episodes of this show lately. We've had a little bit of a break and our schedule has become a little bit uneven. You know, that's what happens sometimes in life, right? Even the best laid plans sometimes don't work out. But I just want to assure everybody that we're still 100% excited about doing this show. It's not getting canceled or anything like that. And we still want to do like 1 to 2 episodes every month. It just might be a little bit irregular from time to time, depending on the amount of work we have, depending on family stuff and so on. So hope you'll all stick with us. And we really, really appreciate your patience as we kind of figure out the schedule going forward.
Yeah, I think it's a nice surprise, right? Just keep your podcast player of choice subscribed, and every now and then there will be a new Stack Trace episode for you to enjoy, and it will be a nice surprise.
Exactly. In a way, it's more exciting than having it drop like on a fixed day every week, right? Even though, of course, I know a lot of people prefer that, and I prefer that as well for some shows. Like when you really are waiting for that next episode, it's really nice when you know when it's going to happen. But yeah, this way you get a little bit of surprise, like you said, Rambo.
Yeah, of course. And we always say, right, if you are a content producer of any kind, like a YouTuber or blogger or anything like that, and of course for podcasters, you should always have like a fixed schedule. But hey, this is a thing we do for fun. We already have an established audience. I think we earn the ability to do this without being too much of a problem for us.
Yeah, it all depends, like we've said also many times, like what's your goal with what you're creating, right? Like is your goal to, I don't know, promote a product or grow an audience or build some kind of brand or a company or something? Like those are different goals. And our goal with this show is to basically like share what we've been working on, learnings from that, talk about technology, talk about upcoming Apple products, talk about how Swift and iOS development is evolving and so on, and other kinds of programming. But to do it in a more casual way, right? Like we don't really have any specific business goals with this podcast. It's more, two friends having fun. And, you know, the schedule kind of reflects that. But yeah, I absolutely agree. Like if you want to make something consistent, well, it's a good idea to have it be consistent. And I think we want to reach that with the show to some extent now with this new schedule and so on. Like we definitely want it to be a little bit more regular, but, you know, scheduling things is always hard, especially when you have, you know, family and you have lots of apps to work on and you have other things. So yeah, it can be tricky, but this podcast remains a priority. Definitely. It remains a product in our lineup, right, Rambo?
Definitely. Definitely still a product in our lineup.
Yes. So with that all being said, let's do this episode. Really exciting. And I think we have some fun things to talk about. And the first thing I want to ask you, Rambo, is what have you been up to lately? And how's it going with both AirBuddy and Chibi Studio? Because this is kind of the whole app updating season that we're still in, especially for you who are developing macOS apps, because we just had the release of the first version of Ventura. So I guess you've been busy.
Oh, yes, I have. So as we talked about, I believe I've been working on AirBuddy 3, a major update to the app for quite a while. And it's a really big update. It deserves the major version bump. And because of that, it wasn't anywhere near ready for macOS Ventura. So I had to do a little bit of course correcting, if you may. My plan originally was to... So the latest version was 2.5, and I wasn't planning on releasing any other major... minor versions, not patch versions, before 3.0, but then the whole Ventura schedule and my schedule didn't line up, and there were a few things I had to fix for macOS Ventura, as well as little bits and pieces of new features that I had to include as well. And for AirBuddy specifically, there's a thing that happens, which can happen at any time of the year, but also it's especially tricky when it happens around the time a new version of macOS is also being released, which is Apple can release a new headset, basically.
Right.
So this time they released the new AirPods Pro 2nd Gen, which I, since we last spoke, I've gotten mine, and I can say that I love it, just as you mentioned during your initial impressions. And so usually, like, if it's a very minor update, which you could look at this new version of the AirPods and think it's a minor update, but actually a lot of things changed about assumptions and the underlying architecture of how the AirPods work. Like the packet formats and whatnot are still the same, but there are lots of behaviors and assumptions that have been broken, and not broken in like in a bad way necessarily, just like assumptions that I had and that all software that deals with AirPods has, which changed with the new AirPods Pro 2nd Gen. So I would have to do that and also have a version for macOS Ventura. And that's how I decided to get a version 2.6 out with AirPods Pro 2nd Gen support and a bunch of fixes for macOS Ventura.
Cool. Yeah, it's always tricky, right? When you want to do some kind of hot fix or compatibility fix or something while you're developing a big new release. And because sometimes the code bases can diverge quite a bit, and especially if you're doing some kind of refactoring or something like that, or big architectural changes as part of a new major version, which is very, very common because you might be introducing some big new functionality that then puts additional pressure on your architecture, and to kind of fix that, you need to change a bunch of things. And then that can make it hard to sometimes go back to the old version and kind of cherry pick commits onto that because the structure might have changed quite a bit. So that is a very, very common challenge. And the way, like, I feel like you can typically kind of deal with those things is to try to keep things as modular as possible when it comes to the changes you make. And this is where having like a relatively clean Git history and having good commit messages and having things be as atomic as possible and not be too huge can really, really help, because even though you might not be able to do a direct cherry pick because of those architectural changes that I mentioned, you could perhaps do one where you just have to make some minor tweaks and still kind of get that functionality in there if you want to do like a cherry pick or a hot fix. So that's what I typically strive for, at least. And you know, sometimes when I work with different people in different teams, I feel like different developers, they have different kind of preferences when it comes to commit messages and version control and so on. And some people maybe don't really see the big benefit in having like a really structured kind of commit history and paying a lot of attention to that. But this is one of those cases where I always use as an example of when it really pays off to structure things in a good way, even if you're working by yourself or in a small team, because it just saves you so much time if you need to do one of those kind of separate releases while you're working on another big release.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was basically my approach. And you hit the nail on the head there about big architectural changes and refactors, because I usually do major architectural changes and things like that in major versions, and that's definitely the case with AirBuddy 3. So there have been quite a few changes to the underlying architecture of some of the components, and also some things that moved between different modules that were previously in like a framework A, and now they're in framework B because of other things that I'm planning. So it was definitely a challenge, and the way I approached it was to basically pick a branch from the shipping version, so the 2.5 dot something that was the current release version at the time, and that was the 2.6 branch. I also have a GitHub issue where I basically did like a huge checklist with all of the fixes from version 3 that I would want to or have to cherry pick into this 2.6 branch, because in the version 3 branch, I already had a bunch of fixes for macOS Ventura, so I didn't see a reason to not just cherry pick those. And fortunately, most of them I was able to cherry pick directly without any major issues. There were a few that required more manual intervention, but overall it was fine. And then I developed the additional support for the new AirPods in the 2.6 branch, and then moved that over to the 3.0 branch after I shipped version 2.6. So I went to the past and then brought the fixes back to the future.
Nice, I love it. And I think this is a good example of the approach I usually like to take when it comes to kind of future-proofing my code, or the Git history in this case, or like the architecture and whatever it is you're working on within a given project, where it's impossible to tell the future, right? Like even if you do a lot of architectural work and you try to plan for the future and you try to like create a super sophisticated architecture that will never create any problems and it will always solve all the use cases, like that's just typically doesn't work, right? It's impossible to predict the future, and it's impossible to know what kind of additional pressure that will be put on this architecture in the future because of new features or structures or changes to the platform and so on and so forth. So the way I like to approach this usually is like my number one priority is usually modularity, in the sense that I want to be able to break certain assumptions, either when it comes to like my commits and so on, or like the way the app is architected. I want to be able to like replace parts of it without breaking everything. So modularity is usually a very high priority for me, because that way, if I need to, in this case, for example, move some commits over to another branch, if those commits are somewhat atomic and modular, that's easier to do. And if you look at something like an app architecture, if you have like good separation of concerns between the different parts of an architecture, then it's usually easier to go in and refactor and change one layer without having to change everything. So I think this is a really good example of when decoupling, like when that becomes something that really pays off.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing that is, I guess, something that makes this process a little bit easier is that I'm not that concerned with the long-term maintainability of this 2.6 branch that I pulled, because this is kind of a one-off thing, and it's probably gonna be messed with for minor fixes that I might want to release before version 3, but after that, it's dead. Like, I'm not gonna touch that version of the code anymore. So, of course, I don't want it to be a mess, but it doesn't have to be this perfect thing that will be resilient for the next 10 years or something.
Yeah, that's actually a really, really good point. It's kind of similar in a way to how in game development, like if you look at some game code, like some people sometimes share their code or it's open source, then you can look at it and it's really kind of messy sometimes, right? And you see all this like hacks or like shortcuts being taken, and not a lot of regards to kind of creating these kind of very sophisticated architectures on kind of a component by component basis, like we typically do when we work on app projects that are being maintained for a long time. And the reason why a lot of people write code this way in that context is because, well, you build a game, you ship it, and you're done. Especially if you're doing like console development, and let's say you're shipping a game on PlayStation 5, you're shipping it on PlayStation 5 and that's it, right? Like you have a fixed target, you ship it there, that's it. Of course, that is kind of changing as more platforms are becoming backward compatible, and then you have these games as a service kind of thing that are more like app projects and that they're ongoing. But still, I feel like that's a very good point. Like if you are just getting a release out of the door and you know this is just a, you know, patch release that I'm just getting for compatibility for this operating system, you can get that out of the door and you can kind of just focus on solving the problems. And then you can move on to your kind of main branch where you focus a lot on the maintainability of the code.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. I never thought of games like that, but it makes perfect sense, because when there are any like major updates to games, it's usually these days in the form of the little packs of stuff that you can buy. And those are already baked into the game in a way where they can just attach to the existing game without requiring big changes to the game itself. It's kind of, you can think of them as like plugins in a sense. And when there's like a game and then there's the game version 2, they usually do something that we say all the time you should not do in software, which is it's usually a rewrite. It's not like they took the first version and then tweaked it and made it better. No, it's a whole new project. So yeah, it's interesting. I guess for people who like to start from scratch a lot, maybe working in the gaming industry would be a good fit.
Right, exactly. And of course, like, there's always exceptions and different teams do things differently. And some teams have like a core engine they develop and they bring that forward and maybe they just tweak it for every project and so on. So there are lots of different approaches. And I also want to be clear that I'm not saying like, oh, all game developers just write hacky code. No, not at all. Like, I'm just saying like the priorities are different, right? When you know that you're building a specific product for a specific target and a specific release, and you just want to get it out of the door, you are going to make different decisions than if you're prioritizing some kind of long-term maintainability of a code base. And I think as developers, the more we can kind of switch those perspectives as we work on different projects, or in your case here, different branches or releases, it's very beneficial because I think it makes you more pragmatic. And I think the same thing is true, for example, if you're writing some kind of script or something that you're either just going to run a few times and not really maintain for a long time, or it's something that is just like doing a very specific task and you don't really care too much about like extending it and maintaining it over time, you will perhaps write the code there in a slightly different way and not spend too much time on like setting up a sophisticated architecture and so on, because we always have to look at these things as investments. Like, if we spend more time with the architecture, with modularity and stuff like that that we discussed, that is an investment you can make for the future. But if you don't foresee that future ever happening, well, maybe that investment is not worth making.
Yeah, definitely. It's the same reason why we sometimes, after we say it depends, when someone asks if they should write their app in React Native or Flutter, we say it depends. And we say usually like, if you're a startup and this is like your MVP, then maybe, yeah, like it doesn't really matter what technology you use as long as you can like have a good idea of whether this product is worth your investment, basically. So if you are developing something that you don't plan on maintaining for the foreseeable future or for like 5, 10, 15 years, then do it in whatever and force unwrap in the case of Swift. And I guess a good example of this will be a piece of code you, John, shared with me a while back. And when you shared that code with me, you said explicitly, I'm sharing this with you as long as you don't show this to anyone. And that was the RSS feeds parser you wrote for like importing the episodes from the 9 to 5 Mac feed into our static website.
Right. Yeah, that's a perfect example because that was a piece of software I literally expected to only use once ever, right?
Yeah.
Now it kind of got a second life with you, so that's great. Yeah. But then you have to fix all the bugs. So I still got my investment, right? Yeah. But that's a good example because I didn't spend any time there like structuring the code or thinking about architecture. I was only solving a problem. So I made really kind of ugly solutions there when it came to string parsing and just like string replacement. And just, I just wanted to basically create a feed that had the exact same content as we had before. And I had some validation running on that to make sure it was actually true. And I didn't want the code itself to be something I would keep. It was just about the creating the end result that mattered. And that's a great example. That was the priority for that project. And then for a different project, like an actual app that I'm working on, is a completely different story where, yeah, there, absolutely, it's 100% worth it to invest in architecture, modularity, code style, code quality, et cetera, because that's something I'm going to maintain for years to come, probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so that is AirBuddy then, but I know that you've also been doing some big changes to Chibi Studio, which also probably involves some architectural work, because I know that you've been implementing some pretty big new features in a code base that you've been maintaining for quite a while now, right?
Yeah, so I am taking a break from working every single day, like 9 to 5, almost in AirBuddy, because I need that. And I'm picking up Chibi Studio again because we do have a few new features we want to do in the app, and also some optimization in the sense of getting more people to pay for the app.
Right.
Which is like not my favorite type of work to do, but you have to do it. Otherwise, the app won't have a reason to exist. But The thing is, Chibi Studio was born in 2016, so it's been a while. And the first piece of software I wrote for Chibi Studio was not Chibi Studio, the app itself. Chibi Studio, the app itself, was actually the third piece of software I wrote for Chibi Studio, because the first one was the iMessage extension. Remember those?
I do, yeah.
So it was supposed to be just an iMessage extension in the beginning, and then I wrote the app afterwards. But before all of that, I wrote the Chibi Pack Editor, which is this Mac app that I shared with my illustrator so that we can build the packs that go into Chibi Studio and do asset management and things like that. And you can imagine that this is an old code base. It's a Mac app, and it uses storyboards.
Oh, I see where this is going.
So I think this is the first time now that I am developing a major new feature in the Chibi Pack Editor app, this internal app that we use, because as part of this Chibi Studio update we're working on, we are going to have a weather widget and other weather-related features. And the idea is that the app is going to assemble a little scene with your chibi, and depending on the current weather for your selected location, it will show different elements and different scenes according to the weather. And because of that, we need to have a way to associate different items in different packs with different weather conditions. So like this item is appropriate for temperatures between 0 and 30 degrees Celsius or something like that. And there are lots of criteria that in and of itself is a very interesting project. We can definitely talk more about it after I actually have it working. But so as you can imagine, there's a lot of UI and a lot of like model changes and data storage concerns and things like that go with that. And I'm finding it difficult to add this to the pack editor. I went in thinking, oh, this is easy. I can do this in like 2 hours. And it's been a week.
Classic, right? That's a classic developer thing to do, right? Looks so simple on the surface, but once you dive into the code, it turns out that, you know, prior assumptions, or rather just like prior priorities, might just come back to haunt you. Or like it turns out that what you're trying to insert is just a complete mismatch to how the code is currently organized. So you mentioned storyboards there. So what was it exactly about storyboards? Or is that like the main thing that is preventing you from progressing here?
It's not the main thing. It's just what's the opposite of the cherry on top?
The vegetables on the side, maybe?
Maybe, I don't know. So it's just like one more thing that's making it less enjoyable. Let's leave it at that. Because I don't know, like Interface Builder, I remember when I first got into macOS development, I kind of liked it. And it was nice to have like this visual way to structure things. But I think, and I'm not like one of those auto layout haters you see out there, like it's fine and I actually like auto layout, but I think as soon as auto layout became a thing, Interface Builder broke and never recovered, basically. So every time I use Interface Builder these days, like just from opening the file, a bunch of errors and warnings show up and the file is changed on disk, and then I go and fix everything and then it's back. And maybe this is not a fair criticism of like, if I created a new app today and used storyboards, it would probably be a lot better. But this is an app that I created in 2016, and there is like a main.storyboard with all of the view controllers in there. So this is probably part of the problem. So I'm not going to blame Interface Builder 100%. But yeah, it's just not an enjoyable experience. And I've actually got like a few crashes where I just can't do something in Interface Builder that I have to do because it just crashes. So what I've been doing is I actually am trying to get away from it as much as possible.
So you're rewriting everything in Swift UI, right?
I wish I could. I actually don't know, like, because it's tricky, and we're seeing this happen in public, kind of like with the whole Twitter situation right now, where you look at something like a software system and you say, oh, this is not that difficult. I could make this in like a week or something. It's not that complicated. But then when you go and you start actually looking into the little details and edge cases, then you figure out, oh no, this is way more complicated than I thought it would be. And I think I actually thought at some point, like, maybe if I did like a simplified Swift UI version of this app, it would be faster than trying to fix all of the interface builder stuff and other problems in the code base. Like, because to be clear, it's not just interface builder. It's like interface builder and also like the whole architecture is not great and the code is not great because it's code from Rambo from 2016. I was still fairly new to Swift back then. And it also went through all of the Swift version transitions since Swift 3. So there's a lot of code in there that's not particularly great. So I don't know, maybe this is one of those cases where rewriting would be a good thing, but I don't think I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, I mean, when I said rewrite it with Swift UI, I was joking, right? Like that, I mm-hmm. don't think that is the approach here that you should probably take. I mean, unless you really wanted to completely modernize the code base, you know, going back to talk about what we talked about before around maintainability and investment. So if you felt like you are going to really focus on Chibi Studio now, and you want that to be like one of your main projects, and you're going to spend a lot of time implementing brand new features, make a lot of UI changes, then maybe something like a rewrite, or at least like changing some specific screens, or maybe modernizing some select parts would make a lot of sense because it would give you more flexibility. But if all you're trying to do is just to kind of add a couple of new features now, and then, you know, ship that, let the project be for a while, then come back to it later, then it sounds like making such a huge investment, like completely rewriting things is probably not worth it. And that's, I think, a common fallacy to fall in, right? Like that a lot of developers, ourselves included, like the temptation is so strong to like, if I could only use this modern tool that I really enjoy using rather than using this old one that I kind of either have outgrown or I feel like it's kind of outdated, then, you know, it's the temptation is really, really strong. And I think like, the major issues with Interface Builder is kind of what you brought up there around once auto layout came into the picture and once we started to get like more and more sophisticated views that have more logic inside of them, the problem becomes that Interface Builder is just kind of a snapshot or a preview of what your app might look like when it's being run. It's no longer an actual one-to-one reflection like it was in the early days. So I agree with you, like in the early days of iOS development, Interface Builder was amazing because you could just like drag and drop controls in there and what you saw was what you got, right? Like it was like a one-to-one map and it was fantastic. And then you just wired up those controls, and because it was all in Objective-C, which was very kind of dynamic by nature, it was a great fit for that kind of setup and architecture and context. Yep. But now when we have Swift, we have all these different screens, we have auto layouts, we have apps that should run across multiple devices. Sometimes iOS apps run on the Mac, which I believe Chibi Studio does, right?
Yes, it does. But also, let's keep in mind that I'm talking about the Chibi Pack Editor, which is an internal tool. So that also weighs into the decision and makes it even less interesting to rewrite it.
Exactly. And with all those kind of things in place, that makes it so that Interface Builder can sometimes be just kind of an insufficient kind of reflection of what the app will actually look like and behave like when it's running, right? And that's not to say that Interface Builder is bad. And like I said, I really enjoyed using it in the beginning. It's just that the way we develop modern iOS and Mac apps has kind of evolved in a certain direction, and Interface Builder hasn't perhaps caught up with that. And I think when we see something like Swift UI previews now, that's kind of the successor to Interface Builder in many ways. It solves the same kind of problems while being more kind of in tune with the modern way of developing apps with these new tools. And I think that's fine. Like, I think progress can happen and it should happen. And when it happens, sometimes we have to change which tools we use And that doesn't mean that tools like Interface Builder, you know, are terrible and they were a bad idea from the beginning. No, it just means that times have changed, there are new technologies here, and perhaps we just need to change the way we work.
Definitely. So my approach as of today, as we record, is, so I wanted, of course, to write the weather association thing, let's call it the inspector. I think that's what Xcode calls the side panes. I wanted to write it in SwiftUI, of course, because I don't want to do Interface Builder or raw AppKit anymore. So I basically dropped like an empty view controller in Interface Builder and created like a custom NS view controller subclass. And in that NS view controller, I just put an NS hosting view and put my SwiftUI view in there and bridge into the model layer using a observable object. However, I'm still having some issues with data flow, where the way the document model, because this is a document-based app, the way the document model observes changes and then like marks itself as dirty in order for it to show like the modified thingy and let you save it and things like that, that's kind of weird. And I haven't really figured out why yet. So I think my focus, as soon as we finish the recording today, which is when I'm going to go back to that, is going to be on figuring out what the data flow is in this app and perhaps like try to simplify it. Because I think over the several years it's been in development, there's been like lots of little bits and pieces around the whole app that basically take pieces of models and shove them into the document model and then tell the document model to update itself instead of like having a centralized per document thing where the data flows in one direction and all changes coalesce into the single point. So it's basically messy because I didn't know what I was doing back then. Probably don't know what I'm doing today either, but I know what I'm doing a little bit better than I knew back then.
You're creating now different solutions and also creating different problems, right?
Exactly. That's like my favorite thing to do. Just create different problems.
Well, it sounds like you have some interesting challenges ahead of you, and I'm wishing you the best of luck. But I'm sure you'll be able to strike a nice balance there between maybe like rewriting some select parts, maybe some parts of the model layer, like you just talked about, adding some Swift UI where it makes sense, wrapping that in a hosting view and so on, making sure that data flow works well and you can share the data between the AppKit-based part of the app and the Swift UI-based part of the app. And I think you will probably strike a nice balance that way because you will be able to move quickly on the new UI with Swift UI while still leveraging all of your existing UI and your existing models. In fact, I was just working on something like that for a client project where there was some existing data models that I could have made a decision to completely change them. And for example, they were class-based, they were even like NS objects and Objective-C compatible for, you know, legacy reasons. And I could have chosen to like make them all Swift structs and completely like change everything. But instead, I just chose to focus on the UI and I created just new views with Swift UI and I just annotated those previous classes with observable object and at published and so on. And it all worked. Like it all worked and I could completely like reduce the risk of interacting with the data model layer there because I knew it worked based on the previous implementation. So my new UI, it could only focus on being the best UI it can be and being all in Swift UI instead of having to worry about also rewriting the entire data layer and making sure that it all works as intended.
Yeah, that's a great approach. And it's what I'm trying to achieve here, basically. We'll see how it goes. Maybe next time we talk, I can give you an update. One of the things I managed to do in the legacy part of the app was to replace a collection view, in this case, an NS collection view, because this is on the Mac, replace it from using the old flow layout and data source based approach with the diffable data source and the new compositional layout. So that was actually a good thing that I managed to do because now I can have individual items refresh really easily and animations when you delete stuff and whatnot. And I know you've also been doing some work with UI Collection View in your case, which, by the way, as a fun fact for our listeners, I'm pretty sure most of the underlying implementation of NS Collection View on AppKit and UI Collection View on iOS are shared. And even you can look on the Mac sometimes on stack traces from NS Collection View and you'll see UI Collection View in there.
Right.
So if you use UI Collection View on iOS and you need to use NS Collection View on the Mac, they're quite similar. But with that fun fact out of the way, what have you been up to, John?
Yeah, so that was a really excellent segue, Rambo, there. That is absolutely true. I have been doing a lot of work with UI Collection View, and I thought it would be fun to just talk about UI Collection View here a little bit, especially around layouts, because like you mentioned, there are a couple of different ways to do layouts with UI Collection View. So just to recap here for those of our listeners who haven't used UI Collection View a lot, basically UI Collection View enables you to build different kinds of lists and grids on either iOS or macOS or tvOS and watchOS too, I guess. Maybe not watchOS, but tvOS, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, you can build lists and grids where you can render things in a very kind of freeform way, where you can either use a pre-built layout like UI Collection View Flow layout that flows items, like it starts from the top left and then it adds items until it reaches the end of a row, and then it starts a new row. So if you have, for example, let's say a grid of photos, you could have a flow layout where, depending on the screen size, you might fit different kinds of photos and different amounts of photos per row, and then you move to the next row. And then you can also use these relatively new compositional layouts, which have been around for several years now, where you can instead compose different layouts together. So you could have, for example, one section that have full width rows, like looks more like a traditional list, like a table view. And then you can mix that with something like maybe a grid or maybe some cards or a carousel or something like that. And then you could have different sections have different layouts in a very neat way. And then you could build also completely custom layouts. So you could subclass the UI Collection View layout subclass, which is an quote unquote abstract class, which doesn't really exist in Swift or Objective-C, but in this case, we can call it an abstract class. And you add your own implementations, and there you could really define whatever layout really you want. And this is what I like so much about UI Collection View. I think it, to this day, remains absolutely probably my favorite number one UI kit view. It's so versatile, and there's so many things you can do with it. But of course, with power usually comes complexity, right? Where,
yeah,
especially if you're building your own layout from scratch, it usually involves like computing frames manually, and you have to make sure you have good performance when you're doing that. And you have to like return an array of layout items for a specific rectangle. And then you have to compute what items are in this rectangle, because one other key feature of UI Collection View is that it does reusing of cells and views. So as you scroll, you get cell reuse. So you save a lot of memory that way, and you get good performance while scrolling. But that also means that your layout has to be very dynamic and just be able to, on the fly, compute different item sizes and layouts. And that can be pretty tricky to implement sometimes. But what I want to talk about here is there was a case that I had now very recently in one of my client projects where I was going to build a grid, and this grid had a couple of different requirements where it needed to be very, very dynamic, and it needed to react to the number of items that are in the grid and whether or not the view is in landscape or portrait orientation and lots of other different factors. And so these days, when I'm going to build something with UI Collection View, I usually start with a compositional layout because I feel like, yeah, that is in general a good practice. It can do so many things, and you can start with some simple layout, and then you can like add nested groups of layouts and so on. So you could have like a horizontal group that goes to a vertical group, kind of like how you can have an H stack and V stack in Swift UI, right?
Yeah.
And you can kind of build your layouts that way. You can have fractional widths and fractional heights. So I would say the vast majority of grids that I've built over the last couple of years can be very nicely expressed with compositional layouts. But this was one of those cases where, because compositional layout is, like Swift UI, very declarative, like you declare upfront the layout in a more abstract way that is not necessarily tied to your current data. You can't really introspect the data and see, okay, if this item has this content, then I should have this kind of layout, because the layout is decoupled from the actual content that a collection view is rendering, which is really good from kind of an architectural point of view. Going back to modularity that we talked about earlier, it's great that the layout is not super aware of the content and vice versa, right?
Yeah.
But in my case, and in many cases also that I've had, the two are kind of inseparable because the content informs the layout and you kind of need to know what you're rendering before you can decide how to render that. And this is where I will still to this day reach for a custom collection view layout. And that's what I did in this case too, where I get that power to be able to compute things exactly how I want to. And whenever I'm writing a custom collection view layout, I always start by thinking, oh, this feels like a failure. It feels like a failure for me that I have to write a custom collection view layout. It kind of almost feels like over-engineering. I feel bad about it. I feel like I should be using the compositional layout because it's so much kind of more high-level, nicer tool. Apple takes care of all the actual computations. I don't have to do any kind of manual frame math. It feels like I'm going backwards to go to a custom collection view layout. And it also feels like I'm going to have to write thousands of lines of code to make this work, right? It's going to be a huge project and it's going to take so much time. But then in reality, every single time when I should be learning this lesson now, but every single time when I actually write a custom layout, it turns out that it's not that complicated. And it turns out in this particular case, I ended up with like 150 lines of code or something for this actually pretty complex layout. And it all was pretty neat and nice at the end. And it's because when you boil it down, really the only two major things you have to do in a collection view layout is you have to be able to return, like I mentioned earlier, an array of layout items for a specific rectangle. So you basically have to compute what items exist in this rectangle and what frames do they have. And then the other thing you need to be able to do is the system can ask you for the layout attributes for a specific key path, like for a specific item, and you return that. But between those two, there's a lot of potential for code reuse, right?
Yeah.
Because the way you compute the layout for an item at a given index path is usually the same as you compute it within a rectangle. The first thing you only have to identify is which index paths do I have within this rectangle. So as soon as you've written that kind of mapping code, the rest is pretty straightforward. So every time I do write a custom collection view layout, I have this feeling afterwards that, whew, that was actually really worth it, because now I don't have to find some really hacky, tricky, you know, complicated way to fit what I was trying to build into the compositional layout system or flow layout system. I could just take complete control of it and actually end up with simpler code in the end, because what I was trying to build was so custom, so it actually warranted a custom solution.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm interested in this specific case that you are mentioning. Why exactly couldn't you use flow layouts or the compositional layouts?
So the compositional layouts and the flow layouts, I feel like they kind of break down when the layout really needs to adapt to exactly what content you're rendering and how many items you have. So for example, if you just want to express that, you know, I want a 2x2 grid, for example, or 3x3, 4x4, whatever it might be, then a compositional layout is fantastic for that because it's a well-defined kind of layout that you have no matter what you're rendering. But let's say you're working on some kind of photos app or something where you're saying that, oh, if I have X number of featured photos, then I want to have this specific layout. Or if I have a photo with this aspect ratio, then I want to render it this way. And if I have these other three photos coming after it, then those should be rendered that way. So it becomes more an exercise of looking at what content you're rendering and then deciding what the layout should be. And that's not really something that compositional layouts do very well.
Oh, I see. Yeah. And you can use the, and let me grab some air to say this protocol name, UI Collection View Delegate Flow Layout.
that is great. Yeah, that is a long delegate name for sure. That is great when you want to tailor like on a per item basis when using a flow layout, which is a very specific layout, right? Yeah. When you're moving like from top left to, you know, moving and adding things row by row. But if you're building something a bit more freeform, think about like something like a photos timeline where the different photos have different sizes and it might be depending on what photos you're actually rendering and so on, that you want to really be things to be very dynamic. You, I guess, could find a way to fit that into flow layout. And I want to be very clear about this. Like, I'm sure there was a way to fit what I was trying to build into either flow layout or compositional layout, but I tried and it turned out to be much more complicated than actually just writing a custom layout instead. And I think that's kind of the point that I'm trying to make here, is that if you're building something that doesn't fit neatly into these boxes, then going outside the box and actually building your own layout is not a bad thing. Like, it's just that I don't think it should be the default. And that's not the default for me either. Like, I always try with the built-in layouts first, and then only if it feels too complicated, that's when I go to a custom layout.
Yeah, I think that's that can be expanded to pretty much everything in like the APIs that we use. If you feel at any point you're fighting with the solution you're trying to use, which seems to have been the case for your example, then you're probably taking the wrong approach. Like, sometimes you have to fight the tools and the APIs and whatnot, that happens. But in your case, there is a lower level tool that's designed specifically to solve the problem that you have, and you're fighting with the higher level options, trying to make them fit into your problem space, and that's not working, or it's looking like it's getting too hacky. That's when you take a step back and you try to actually use the lower level thing. Because let's say you manage to do it with flow layout or compositional layout, what if iOS 17 changes some slight behavior about the of course, you could fix it, like it's usually not a big deal, but you always have to think about if you're trying to like undo what the tool is doing or the API is doing for you in order to get it to do what you want, then you're probably taking the wrong path.
Exactly. You never want to feel like you're fighting the system, or at least not unless you really, really have to. Sometimes you do have to fight the system, but you know, you want to feel like the path you're taking is kind of the path of least resistance, if you will. And like I said, like, I'm sure that there was a way to build this exact layout I wanted to build with compositional layout, but it would involve, for sure, like a lot of kind of complicated setup code and invalidating the layout maybe more often than I should, and recomputing it and so on, and then using some delegation and closures for a more dynamic behavior. And that also, like, it also goes back to, if you're building something that is maybe a little bit more complicated, but it's all contained in one class, that can sometimes be way simpler than if you have something that maybe piece by piece is a little bit simpler, but there are many moving parts and many pieces, because then you have to kind of jump around in the code to figure things out if you're trying to like change this in the future. While in my case now, if I want to change this grid layout in any way, I just go to my gridlayout.swift file, and there's these 150 lines, which are all documented and all clearly named with separate functions and good code reuse and good variable names, and I can just update it there, right? And in the end, that I think in this case, and in cases like it, becomes simpler.
Yeah, definitely. So how did you hook up the data that you need to inform the generation of your layout into the layout itself? Do you like feed some model into it, or how does that work?
Oh, that's easy, Rambo. You just inject the view controller right into the layout and no problems.
Weak var view controller.
Right. Well, the layout actually does have a back reference to the collection view, right? So
yeah,
it is a little bit like a two-way relationship there. But what I actually did was I created a separate, like almost like a view model, like a configuration for the layout that contains all of the information the layout needs from the data without actually looking at the data itself. And then I injected that into the layout. And when I need to update it, I just set that property that invalidates the layout. It gets recomputed the next render cycle, and there you go.
Nice.
So that becomes really, really simple, and I actually still have pretty much a single source of truth, with the only exception that I need to wire up the actual model to this kind of configuration value. But as long as that's done, then there's like a single source of truth, which is the data, which also is what I really, really like with this setup.
Awesome. Yeah. The reason why I'm asking so much is that I have a situation where I think I might need to use a custom layout. Of course, I'll try the other options first, but we'll see. If I end up writing one, I'll let you know how it went.
Yeah, and you can always let me know if you have any questions. At this point, I feel like I've written so many custom UI collection view layouts that I'm getting pretty good at it. It's one of those things where the more you practice, the better you get at it. Which I don't know if like it's the most useful skill these days in iOS development, but still, it's nice to have sometimes.
Definitely.
Yeah, and this whole equation also becomes even more interesting when I bring up the fact that this collection view layout is actually being used in an app that is mostly written in Swift UI.
Ooh.
So I wasn't only kind of choosing to dive deeper into UI collection view and write a custom layout. I also chose to use UI collection view rather than writing this particular part of the app in Swift UI. And it goes back to the exact same thing that I talked about earlier, where building this very, very dynamic, like custom layout with Swift UI without the iOS 16 APIs with the layout protocol and so on, which I can't use in this app because of the deployment target, would be even more complicated and be even more fighting the system because I would have to basically use a lot of geometry readers and set manual frames and basically do the same thing that I'm currently doing in my UI collection view layout, but in Swift UI, which would be a complete mismatch, right? Like I would be using very kind of imperative patterns to compute the layout in a completely declarative framework, which would be a complete mismatch. And this is again why I felt like a custom layout was a good fit here, because what I needed to do was kind of inherently very imperative code, and having it be in that context that matches that, I feel like is better than trying to fit it into some declarative context that where it really doesn't fit.
Yeah, collection view or a replacement for the equivalent of UI collection view or NS collection view in Swift UI is, I think, like the biggest missing piece of the puzzle right now, because yeah, we have lazy vGrid and lazy hGrid and grid layouts with iOS 16 and stuff like that. But it all it does is layout. But collection view does a lot more than layout. It also handles selection. And I think that's like a huge deal. It handles selection, drag and drop, and lots of other things that these grid options that you have in Swift UI, they just don't do right now. So if you have a Swift UI app, especially if you're targeting the latest OS versions and you have like just a grid of things that people can tap to open something, lazy vGrid, hGrid, it's perfectly fine for that. But if you have something like the Chibi Studio home page where you have this grid of chibis and you can enter editing mode and select a bunch of them and delete them and drag and drop and things like that, then Swift UI really doesn't have an answer for that yet.
Yeah, and this goes back to what we've been saying many times on the show, is that we like to use the right tool for the job. And yep, it's going to be the case for, I think we can just expect for many years forward, at least a few years forward, that sometimes still UIKit will absolutely be the right tool for the job. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, I absolutely don't mind using all of the richness that UIKit has built up over the many years it's existed. And UI Collection View is one of them. Like, UI Collection View was introduced in iOS 6, so it wasn't available from day one, but it was added later, and that was like several years after the original release of iOS. So we're going to have to wait a few more years for a similar thing, I think, to appear in Swift UI, and that's fine, because we have UI Collection View.
Yeah, absolutely.
So hope you enjoyed this episode of Stack Trace. It was really, really nice to talk to you all again and to record another episode of the show. I've definitely missed it and can't wait to record the next one, which will be coming up soon. But until then, thanks so much for listening, everybody. And say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.